Good. This is an interview for the University of Adelaide Oral History Project with Sam Jacobs. The date's the 23rd of August 2007. The interview is being conducted at Glen Osmond. Well, Sam, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed. I was wondering if you could just tell me firstly, where and when were you born?
Born at Glenelg in 1920, 6th of December.
And could you tell me a bit about your parents, please?
Well, my father was born in Adelaide and lived all his life in Adelaide. My mother was a Queenslander. I don't quite know how my father came to meet her. I think it was somewhere at some mutual friend's place in Victoria, but at all events, she was came from Brisbane. They were married in 1917 in Brisbane. And then, of course, came to live in Adelaide, where my older sister was the firstborn in 1918, I think, and then I was born in 1920.
So what were your parents' names then?
My father was Roland Ellis Jacobs, Ellis being his mother's maiden name, and my mother's maiden name was Hertzberg. Her father had been an immigrant, I think, from Hamburg in the early 1880s, and became quite a distinguished citizen in Brisbane, establishing a business mainly of importers, which got into difficulties during the Depression, as I understand it. I never knew him. He died before I was. Well, the first time I visited Brisbane, he'd already died.
Mm. So, Sam, where was your education in Adelaide?
At Scotch College, primary at Scotch College. I was enrolled when I was 8 years old and stayed there for the next 10 years, leaving at the end of 1938, in which year I was head prefect, captain of the school in 1938. And had a very interesting and rewarding year, having matriculated before that. In those days, one matriculated at what is now the leaving standard. And then I went on and did leaving honours after matriculation. So I was under no great academic pressure after matriculation.
Was Mr. Grattan the headmaster?
Mr. Grattan was the headmaster for the whole of my time there. And I was president of the Old Scholars Association in 1950, I think it was, when he retired. And I was largely responsible for the ceremonial that attended that event. He'd been the first headmaster.
Mm. Sam, what took you to the University of Adelaide in the first place as a student?
I'd made up my mind quite early at school that I wanted to be a lawyer. And I don't quite know how. The only legal background was my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, who had graduated in law in Victoria in about 1875 or thereabouts. And he did practice here in Adelaide for a short time in the early 1880s in a firm then called Stock and Jacobs. But he gave up the practice of the law when he became involved in the business community, and in particular with the South Australian Brewing Company.
And your father himself had been involved with SA Brewing as well, is that?
Later. After his father died, my father was invited to become the managing director of the brewing company. But that was 10 years or more after my grandfather's death.
So there was a slight connection to the law through your grandfather.
That's right.
But you've got no idea what attracted to it. To you.
No, I don't really know what attracted it to me, but I know I was firmly entrenched, and indeed Mr. Grattan insisted that I should do mathematics in my matriculation years because it was a good training of the mind in thinking and in logic, and he was quite right. I was very glad that I'd done mathematics, even though I had no practical use for it in later life.
Now, after your year at Scotch College, Sam, did you go immediately to university?
I went to the university in 1939, 39 was my fresher year, and that was a relatively uneventful year, although of course war broke out in September of that year, and our futures were immediately became uncertain. But I finished the first year, and I started the second year in 1940, and in fact was co-editor of On D.
Is that right?
In 1940. But that was fairly short-lived because, well, for two reasons. One, I had a brush with the district censor, which might have led me to resign, but I didn't have to resign because I was posted to an officer training school at Liverpool in New South Wales. And at the conclusion of that school, I was commissioned and posted to a unit which was designed for service in the Middle East. So that I only really did about one term of my second year at the university.
Could we go back to the beginning of your time at university, Sam? What did the place look like at that stage of its life?
Look, it was like a large school. There were only about 800 graduates, I think, and almost about the same size as St. Peter's College in terms of numbers. And, you know, one tended to know lots of students in other faculties. There was much more inter-faculty mingling in those early days than there was later on. And a good deal of staff mingling too. We used to have morning tea with members of the staff in the refectory, and it was a very relaxed and friendly atmosphere.
I was just thinking, the union buildings would have been quite new by that stage.
Well, yes, they were, but they had the George Murray building and the Lady Simon building, the refectory, and those were the three main buildings. There'd been no upper-level extensions, of course, to the union or to the refectory at that stage.
So as far as the law school went and lectures, where were they held in your first year?
They were held in the Mitchell building. Upstairs in the Mitchell building was the law school. The only full-time academic was Professor Campbell. Lecturing was done by visiting legal practitioners, but he was the only full-time member of staff. But it was in the... I can't quite describe where in the Mitchell building, but
was it the
round about where the... I think what they call the Henry Baston room is now, in that part of the Mitchell building. On that... eastern wing of the Mitchell building.
So it wasn't the large Prince of Wales Theatre?
No, we had lectures in the Prince of Wales Theatre. We had Latin. I did Latin one in the Prince of Wales Theatre, but no, we had... There was a lecture theatre of some sort in the precincts of the law school in the Mitchell building.
Who took you for Latin one, Sam?
Fitzherbert, Professor Fitzherbert. Yes. We used to rag him a bit, I'm afraid, and we used to sign. They used to pass around the roll to be signed, and all sorts of strange people were doing Latin one, like Sir Donald Bradman and Jack Crawford and all the sporting heroes of the day. All used to sign the roll as Latin one.
What were the other subjects you might have taken in first year?
I did my first year. I did Latin one. Psychology and logic, both with Professor Michaela Stewart.
Oh yes,
and elements of law, which was done with Professor Campbell. That was the introduction to legal method and legal language. But there's not much substantive law in it, but that was our introduction to legal studies. But the first year was. If you're going to do an A or B, you had to have a quota of arts units, and mine with Latin and psychology and logic.
So what was Professor Michaela Stewart like?
A doer Scot. But I think he was quite a good... teacher. I can remember those courses were all a bit obscure for probably one or two terms, but somehow he brought them all together to make sense in the third term, and it was a... But he had no rapport with students at all. It was a... It was, and indeed, nor did Campbell have much rapport with students at a social level.
Mm. So, did you have tutors as well as those people?
No, no tutors.
So, did you do tutorials at all?
No. No, I never had any tutorials. At any stage of my university career did I have did I have tutorials. Although, when I came back from the war and went back into the law school, the numbers were very, very small because law was not, of course, a protected occupation. And the only people doing law were those who could not enlist, mainly. And we had some very small groups. And in fact, they were conducted very much as tutorials because of the small numbers, rather than as formal lectures. I can remember Edgar Stevens was one of the people, and Lou Whitington, and they were tutorial-like sessions.
Mm. Was much of your time spent in the Barr Smith Library?
In my first year, yes, I spent a bit of time there because some of the external reading in psychology and logic was only available in the Barr Smith Library. It wasn't available in the Law Library. And I used to work a bit in the Barr Smith Library, in the sitting at one of the long tables, but after I came back from the war, I hardly used the Barr Smith Library at all.
Mm. So, in the first year, Sam, were you also involved with sport at all at university?
Yes, I played B-grade cricket. that was my and golf. I played intervarsity golf in 1940, just before war broke out, 1939, 1940. You know, I played intervarsity golf. But I remember we played at a Commonwealth course in Victoria, and I can tell you pretty well who the members of our team were. Ackland Horman was our leading player, and of course he was an Australian, leading Australian player, and Peter Jay,
all right,
and Colin Gurner, Michael Dawson, John Dunstan, and me, and Gay Thornton. I think that was the intervarsity golf team.
Oh.
Most of them were doctors.
I picked up that with Gurner.
Yeah.
So, did you find there was quite great camaraderie there?
Where?
At university proper.
No, I don't think so. Perhaps because I didn't make friends all that easily. It's a... I only really... My experience in that the first year and the part of the second year was really sort of very limited, but when I came back from the war, I became much more involved in undergraduate affairs and student politics.
Well, we'll talk about that in a little while. But firstly, how did you get involved with OND?
To be honest, I can't really tell you. I may have... I think I was on the staff as a reporter, as a fresher. Mm. I think I was on the staff in 1939 in my first year as a fresher. And of course, I had edited the school magazine when I was at Scotch. I was a reporter, and then I don't quite know. I was co-editor with Primvina Smith. We were co-editors.
Mm. Was that pretty standard that a man and woman were the co-editors?
Well, I think it was quite unique at that stage. I don't think it had happened before.
Mm.
I don't quite remember who the editors were before me. George Amos, I think, was one. And I can't really... Crisp, I imagine, was probably an editor of OND as well. But I'm not even sure about that.
Now, how did you come to have a brush with a local censor?
Well, the local censor happened to be Professor Campbell, my own professor, but he conducted his role as the district censor from a little office in the post office tower in King William Street. I wanted to an article was submitted to us by Elliot Johnston, who even at that stage was a sort of well-known left-winger. And it was a very sensible and rational article, but in which he really sought to explain the rationale of pacifism and its value as an alternative to war in solving international disputes. It was not in any way an attack upon our war effort or criticising our war effort, but putting a point of view that there was an alternative to war, the pacifist alternative. And I thought we should publish it. We were a university, we were supposed to be fighting for the preservation of free speech, and I thought we should publish it. But we had to submit all our material to the district censor, and Campbell wouldn't let us publish it. And I went and saw the Vice Chancellor, who was then Sir William Mitchell, and himself a really great liberal. He was very sympathetic, but he wasn't prepared to intercede. So I was very cross that we were not allowed to publish it, and I may have resigned as a matter of principle, although I always have questioned the value of resignation on principle, because you can't put it right if you've resigned. And it's, but I didn't have to resign, because I joined the militia. I was in the School Cadet Corps at Scotch. In fact, I was an under officer in the School Cadet Corps, and like most of us, we joined the militia after leaving school, because we could see that war was imminent. I was then selected for this officer training school. Mm. And that was the end of my university career for the time being.
So you said that, Sam, that took you to Liverpool.
Yes, in New South Wales.
How long were you there for? A
couple of months.
Yeah.
I topped school, but I was only 19 at the time. And I was commissioned and posted to a unit which was destined for service in the Middle East.
So was you commissioned lieutenant?
Lieutenant, yes. Mm. That was the first commission that I got as a lieutenant.
And into which battalion?
2nd 27th. Well, the 2nd 27th, in fact, had left. I was posted to the first reinforcements for the 2nd 27th.
Mm.
And in fact, we left for overseas in February 19.
41. Yeah.
Mm.
That's my knowledge of the 2nd 27th says that should have happened.
Yeah.
But were there many people in the battalion you knew?
Many, no. There were not, but there were some that I knew.
Mm.
I knew some, and but I was very young and a relative stranger. It was not a very easy posting for me, but I had to manage it.
Hmm. 2nd 27th had a pretty hard time in the Middle East, from what I remember.
We had a hard time in Syria. Just after I joined the unit, which was still in camp in what was then Palestine, we were moved to Mirza Matruh, which was a seaport on the African coast, just a bit west of Alexandria. But it was a little foot, it had been turned into a fortress, really, I think, as a buffer for Cairo and Alexandria.
Mm.
We didn't really see any enemy action there. The first fighting in North Africa, when the Australian 6th Division moved up to Bardia and so on, that had all happened, and Rommel hadn't started to move further east at that stage. So we didn't see the enemy, I don't think, when we were in Mirza Matruh at all. But then the Germans came down into Greece, and we were destined to move from the Mirza Matruh to Greece, but the Germans got there ahead of us, thank goodness, because otherwise we'd all spent out the rest of the war as prisoners of war.
Mm.
But instead of going to Greece, we were sent back into northern Palestine. We were bittered in a kibbutz at the northern boundaries of Palestine, and preparatory to fighting the Vichy French in Syria, who was thought would capitulate, but they didn't. They put up quite stiff resistance, and it took us six weeks to complete that operation. Although when it started, the orders of the day were Beirut or bust. We were supposed to get to Beirut on the first day. We got there six weeks later. And we suffered quite heavy casualties. The 2nd 27th in particular suffered quite heavy casualties. It was all the 21st Brigade, comprised the 2nd 14th Battalion from Victoria and the 2nd 16th from Western Australia, who were on our flanks. There were a few hitches in that campaign. I think the intelligence wasn't very good. And particularly the people on our right flank got held up by a stiff opposition. And we couldn't move forward. We were stuck halfway up because we didn't want to get outflanked from behind. But eventually we got to, there was quite a heavy stoush at a place called Daimur, which really sort of finished off the Syrian campaign. I was in hospital for a little while after that because I got malaria. Not a virulent type, of what they call a benign tertiary, but I had to go to hospital and be treated with the Atabrin and the other various medicines. When I recovered from that, I went back to what they call the training battalion, which was where hospital evacuees rejoined their units via this training battalion, which was representative of the three battalions in the brigade.
So how long were you in active service, Sam?
In the Middle East?
Yes.
Well, we left the Middle East just after Japan came into the war in December 41.
Yeah.
And we were hastily brought home. The 6th and 7th, their poor old 8th Division, of course, was up in Singapore.
Yes, I know. There.
And the 9th Division, which fought later at El Alamein, and they'd been in Tobruk as well.
Yeah.
They remained in the Middle East, but the 6th and 7th Divisions were brought home eventually, because there was a great discussion between Churchill and Curtin when we were halfway home at Colombo. We were all holed up in the Colombo harbour. Churchill wanted to send us to Burma. None of us would have ever returned from there. Mm. But Curtin insisted that we all come back to Australia.
Mm.
And we landed back in Australia. And it was after Darwin was bombed, which was the 19th of February. And we arrived back, I think, either very late February or early March, we arrived back. And we all came back, strangely enough, we were all disembarked in Adelaide.
Mm. Did you then, after a break, go and do jungle training at all?
No, the unit did jungle, went or sent up to the Atherton Tableland to do jungle training. But we had to come back in the same posting as we had when we left. And I was still with the training battalion after having come out of hospital.
Yeah.
And the training battalion didn't go up to Atherton, and we were in camp at Mount Barker, and with nothing much to do. And a lot of the troops that had been disembarked in Adelaide were billeted in private homes in Adelaide, and I volunteered to be a billeting officer to give me something to do. I had quite a large area out at Royston Park, Paynham Way. That, in some way or other, led me into the what was then a local headquarters at Prince Alfred College in Decatur Terrace. And apparently somebody seemed to think that I was suitable for staff work. From there I was posted to a newly formed unit in the Northern Territory called a Movement Control Group, which was quite a new concept. But whose role was really to manage road and rail and air and ship transport in the Northern Territory.
Yeah.
And so I was promoted to captain, and sent up to the Northern Territory. Spent part of my time up there at Adelaide River, which was Norfolk's headquarters. General Herring, who had been Chief Justice of Victoria, was the, he was the commanding officer up there. And but then I spent some time in Darwin, looking after shipping and road transport move and rail. I was in Darwin for the wet season in that year anyway. So I experienced a Darwin wet, and there was quite a lot of Japanese air activity. There were a number of raids on Darwin after the first big raid, and including one in which they did quite a lot of damage and half destroyed a new RAF squadron of Spitfires, which had come up but which didn't know how to fight the Zeros. The Zeros had fought the Spitfires, and prior to the Spitfires we had two squadrons an American fighter aircraft anyway.
Kitty Hawk?
Kitty Hawks, yeah. Mm. Two squadrons of Kitty Hawks were up there. Then I went back to Adelaide at the river, and I became ill. And they discovered that I reported sick with a bit of pain in my chest, and they went away and x-rayed me and put me on the next plane south because they discovered a spot on my lung which they seemed to think was tubercular.
Mm.
And I then spent 6 months in Dawes Road Hospital.
Mm, there was a good deal of TB around, I think.
Yeah, and of course they didn't have penicillin at that stage either.
Mm.
So I was 6 months in Dawes Road Hospital from July 43 until I was discharged in February 44. I was discharged as medically unfit, or put on the reserve of officers anyway.
Mm.
And after a couple of months of further convalescence, I went back to the university.
So straight back into law?
Yes, straight back into law, but I took up the subjects that I had started in my second year in 1940, but which I had to complete at that stage by private study because they were not being lectured in at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I passed those two subjects at the end of that year and then resumed for a period of full-time study.
So this is 45 you resumed?
Hmm?
45?
45 and 46.
Yeah. Now, what was the structure of the course in those last 2 years?
I don't think it had really changed very much. But I had, very wisely, but acting on advice, I'd entered into articles of clerkship before I went away to the war.
Hmm.
And because of my war service, some of my required period of service as an article clerk was remitted. But I had to do those two full years in 45 and 46, and I completed then what was called the final certificate,
yeah,
which enabled me to get admitted, and I finished my degree course after that, and was ultimately my degree was conferred in the ceremony in March 48.
Who were you articled to, Sam?
I was articled... That's a good question. I think I was articled to George McEwen. It was certainly Baker McEwen was the firm. And I think I was articled to old George McEwen.
That's Neil's father.
Neil's father. Yeah. And then when he gave up, retired, my articles were transferred to Eric Milhouse.
Oh, right.
But in fact, I sat at the feet of George Lidgwood before he went onto the bench, and I was his devil.
Right.
And that was very interesting because I had to work on his cases, and he was really, at that stage, he was really the leader of the Australian Bar. He'd conducted the uniform tax case, among others, and was much sought after, and he had big cases, and so I had a lot of useful tuition from him before he became a judge.
So is Lidgetwood at that stage working in a lot of federal law, or what?
Well, he was based here in Adelaide, but he was being briefed by interstate people. He was really, he almost had the same sort of role as Barwick had later as a leader of the Australian Bar. And I was his devil, so that was a good experience for me.
So was he fundamentally a barrister at that
stage? Oh, yes, he did only court work at that stage. And I mean, I did a little bit of solicitor's work as an articled clerk, but I had to go to do a stint in the various other parts of the firm. But I did that mainly after Lidgett Wood became a judge.
Had you known Lidgett Wood prior to that?
Well, I'd known him at school, but he was on the Scottish Council, and I'd been very friendly with his, not with his elder son Bill, who was cooler than Alamein, but with his younger son Neil, who was my contemporary, more or less. And so I'd known the Lidgett Woods at school, and George Lidgett Wood really became my mentor thereafter when he became a judge and he became Chancellor of the University and so on. And it was he who encouraged me to stand for membership of the University Council, saying that I had no chance on my first attempt, but I should put myself forward, which I did, and got in, and beating Tacky Hannon, much to Tacky Hannon's distress.
Well, he'd been on it for many years.
Yes, he had. But he was warden of the Senate, and he'd made a bit of a mess of a few Senate meetings, and I think that... And I was pretty active in the Senate. Roma Mitchell and I were pretty active in trying to promote the role of the Senate, and anyway, I got in. And
what year was that, Sam? Do you remember?
1961. But prior to that, I'd kept up my... When I kept going back a bit, when I came back from the war, I was very active in the student politics and the student union, and I was instrumental in forming the first student representative council, which I think took office in 47. I was a representative on the National Union, Australian University Students, and I was also on an advisory committee for the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme.
Oh, yes.
But I was one of the early beneficiaries of that scheme, and I was a sort of user's representative on that committee. Which
you would have had to be one of the first.
Yes, I really was one of the early CRTS people.
Because that really didn't kick off big time till mid 46, did it?
Well, that's right, and that's about the time I was made the user's representative, because that was my last, full year at university was 46, and in 47 I got married by that time, and I just did the two extra subjects that I needed to complete my degree. But I was pretty active, and I was a chairman of the or president of the union, or whatever they called it in those days. That's when I had an interesting experience, because I developed a program of inviting distinguished people to come and address student meetings at lunchtime. And one of them, I remember, was Malcolm Sargent, who afterwards took me back to a rehearsal of the orchestra, which was very interesting. But another visitor that I invited was Arthur Corwell, who was a Minister of Immigration. And at that stage, there were a fair flow of returned soldiers back at the university, and a lot of them were pretty left and pretty right wing. Particularly the engineers and so on, and they gave Corwell a rough time. They were heckling him and throwing coins at him and so on, and I stopped the meeting. And I sat Corwell down, and I said that the university was a place of freedom of speech, and if people didn't like to, people didn't have to come here if they didn't want him, but at least they should behave in a civilised manner. And I invited those who were called the troublemakers, I said, you'll either keep quiet or you'll leave. And they left, and Corwell resumed his speech. And I received a lot of approval, particularly from some of the senior academics. Jerry Portis was really pleased that I had the strength to tackle these ruffians and shut them up.
Now, Jerry Portis would have been Professor of History at that time?
He was Professor of History at that time.
And was his son then in the law school?
John Portis. Well, yes, I knew John Portis, of course, because for quite a long time he was Secretary of the Law Society before he became a commissioner, an industrial commissioner. I don't know. Jerry Portis was a gregarious professor, and he was fond of students, and, you know, we used to have morning tea and so on, and so he knew me and I knew him, and so, but I'd never studied with him.
Nobody obviously approved of your actions.
Yes, he did, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, it was heavily written up in On Dee at the time, I remember.
So On Dee then was not just a once-a-year newspaper, it was a regular paper?
Oh, it was a regular paper when I was editor back beforehand.
Yeah.
It came out, I'm not sure whether we published weekly or fortnightly, but certainly after the war it was, I think, a regular weekly publication.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have anything to do with it when I came back from the war. I was too much involved in other aspects of student activities.
Sam, from 1946, did CRTS really change the university, do you think, in terms of student numbers?
I think it probably did. Because I think that it enabled some people to come or to resume studies who might not have otherwise been able to do so. And certainly enabled me to get married.
Mm-hmm.
I really got married on CRTS.
Did you have to promise to do certain things with CRTS that you'd...
No. It was I'm just trying to think of the man, the professor in Sydney, the professor of economics who chaired that CRTS committee. I went up to Sydney a couple of times for meetings. The names begin with a B.
Yeah.
Bland? No. It'll come to me.
Hmm.
Anyway.
I hope it comes to me too.
Excuse me. Hello. Where were we? CRTS.
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't remember that professor's name in Sydney.
No, neither can I, and I do know it.
B, it begins with a B.
Yeah.
It'll
come.
Yeah.
But for you, it enabled you to get married, to get through the course, and to begin life afresh.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, look, I was being supported by my parents before that, but it gave me a measure of independence that I wouldn't have otherwise have had.
Did that CRTS also mean that the student group was older, in effect?
It was a great mix. Mm. There was the influx of ex-servicemen. Most of us, we'd become much more worldly as a result of wartime experiences, and there were the usual school leavers, so it was a very mixed student population at that stage.
I guess there would have been those like Harry Medlin as well, who'd been POWs.
He'd been a POW, yes. Mm. Yeah. Yep.
When did you go? No, you were already at Baker McEwen as an article clerk, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
So then you picked up there when you finished your degree.
Well, I became an associate then, yeah. Firstly to Sir George Lidgetwood. Well, he wasn't Sir George then, he might have been. I don't know. Firstly to Lidgetwood, and then to Napier, who was Chief Justice. And in 1948, I think it was, I was invited to join the firm, which was the successor to Stock and Jacobs, which was then called Stevens, Brown, Ryman and Stevens. And they were the successors to the old firm of Stock and Jacobs.
So what was the new firm's name, Sam?
Brown, Ryman and Stevens at that stage.
Brown, Ryman and Stevens.
Brown with an E.
Yeah.
And that was Rymel, that was Arthur Rymel.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
Well, Sir Arthur Rymel, or Arthur Rymel at that point, would have been pretty active on the council, I would have thought, the city council.
Yes, he was Lord Mayor in about 1954. He was Lord Mayor on the Queen's first visit in 54.
Mm.
Yes, he was.
And you were saying it was George Lidgetwood who encouraged you to become involved with the university governance.
Yeah.
Had you any interest in that prior to his...
Oh, yes. Look, I was... in 1950, after Campbell, I think he must have died, I think, and after Campbell died, I became president of the union again for a couple of years, and then I became president of the graduates' union.
Yeah.
And so I had a continuing interest in university affairs right through the 50s, when A.P. Rowe was vice-chancellor.
What was Rowe like, Sam?
What was he like? He was not a very friendly man. I think he had a lot of very good qualities. He steered the university through a period of enormous post-war growth, but he was not trustworthy. He tried to stab people in the back. I can remember when he was appointed, George Lidgett was ecstatic to think that they'd got this distinguished scientist to become vice chancellor, the first paid vice chancellor. And in the end, George Lidgett would move for his dismissal.
Really? Yeah. Changed that much?
Mm. Yes, I'd say he became very unpopular. But he had a lot of very marked administrative and organisational ability, but he was not really trustworthy at a personal level, and at least that was my experience. I mean, I trust everybody until I find that I can't. But I was quite active. I was president of the Graduates Union, and I was, as I said a little earlier, I used to go regularly to Senate meetings and was very interested in the role of the Senate, which at that stage had a legislative function with respect to legislation. And we set up, Roma and I, it was a nonsense to get the whole of the Senate to approve legislation which they knew nothing about. And we set up a committee of the Senate to discharge its legislative function. So I was very much involved. Well, not so very much, but I'd maintained an interest in the university. And when Lidgett would have urged me to stand for council in 1961.
Mm. The person whom you replaced, Taki Hannan, had you known of him previously?
Oh, yes, he was the Crown Solicitor.
Mm.
Oh, yes, I'd known him. I'd known him in a professional sense. That was all, not in any personal sense, but I mean, I'd come across him at Senate meetings and he'd appeared in court when I was associate and so on. So I knew him as a professional man, but I didn't have any personal contact with him. He was very cross. He apparently, to other people, accused me of canvassing for votes when, in fact, I never lifted a finger. Lidgett would said I wouldn't get in, so I didn't even try. But they didn't get in because they liked me. It was because they didn't like Hannan.
I think he came from a Catholic background.
Yes, he did. But there was any anti-Catholic sentiment in the fact that he got beaten. It was just that he was seen to be a bit of a dithery old man.
Mm. He must have served for all of 30 years, I would have thought.
Oh, a long time, yeah.
Who were some of those others that were on council when you first joined?
At that stage? Well, Frank Perry was on the council. And Ray Hone was on the council.
That's Pa Hone, isn't it?
No, his son.
Oh, Pa Hone's son.
His son is Ray Hone. I think the head of the electricity, or Dryden, who was head of the waterworks department, might have been on it at one stage. And I'm not sure whether Milne from the Electricity Trust wasn't on it at one stage too. And Henry Baston was vice chancellor when I joined the council, and Bob Simpson was on the council. Well, yes, he was on the council. I think as chairman of the finance committee. I don't think he'd ever been elected to the council. He was there, and then there were very few academics on the council because it was. The council in those days had to fix the salaries, and it was thought that the academics should not be involved in the body that fixed their own salaries. So it was largely an external membership of the council, which changed very much as the years went by.
Mm. I think in the early days it had largely been academics, though.
Well, it might have been. I don't really know.
Mm.
I don't know. But Sir Lidgett, of course, was there, and Kenneth Wills.
Yes.
Lidgett and Wills were both on the council. And
Did Vic Edgelow attend?
Oh yes, Vic Edgelow was the registrar, and Bampton was he was the university finance man in those early days. But Vic Edgelow was, I think he had become the registrar at that stage. I think that Eardley, I don't think Eardley was on the council when I joined it. I mean, I knew of Eardley as a student, as a young graduate, but when he was registrar, but I think he'd retired when I became onto the council.
So by the time you came in 1961, Sam, was that at the beginning of the real growth of the university?
No, it wasn't the beginning. The growth had really occurred, and a lot of the new building had occurred in the 50s when Rowe was Vice-Chancellor, and there was the post-war. Well, there was the post-war influx, but then, of course, also they were planning, having to plan ahead for the boomers. What do they call them? The
baby boomers.
For the baby boomers, yes. It was the period of real growth, I really think, came a bit later when Whitlam became Prime Minister and the whole funding structure of the university was changed. I can tell you a bit about that too.
I'd love to go into that, but I wonder if I could just first ask you about the Graduates' Union with which you were involved in the 50s.
Yeah.
Could you explain what the function of the Graduates' Union was, please, Sam?
I doubt it really had a function. It was just an old scholars' club. I think it used to organise a few lectures or visits and that sort of thing, but it had no real role in terms of university governments.
Mm.
I always wanted to give it a role because I was very anxious that at some stage, and it has not happened even now, that we should somehow encourage the alumni to support their alma mater. And I'd always sort of hoped that we might be able to stir the graduates of the university into putting the university on their list of charitable donations and so on, but as it happened in America, but it never really happened here. Stranks, many years later, set up a university foundation, but it never really took off.
No, that is a big difference between Australian and North American universities,
yeah.
Certainly. That period of the 1960s when you're first on council, Sam, well, was Roma on at that point as well, Roma Mitchell?
Yes, she was, and Hambly, Frank Hambly was on, I think.
Yes, who would have been Master of Lincoln College.
He was Master of Lincoln College, and I think Grenfell Price was on too.
Archie still, was he? Yeah, he would have been.
Yes, I think Archie was on it too. Yes, and Roma was on it.
Now, was that in effect the decision-making body of the university?
Yes, it was, yeah. Yes, it was.
How quickly did you come on the finance committee, Sam?
I think they put me onto the finance committee quite soon after I was onto the council, but I really became actively involved in, I think, 1965, when Bob Simpson was appointed to the university's commission. And I can remember Lidgetwood and Ken Wills. Lidgetwood was then living in a little house in Fife Avenue at Mitcham, and he rang me up and said he wanted to see me, could I come up? And there was Ken Wills, and they said, we want to make you chairman of the finance committee. And I said, goodness gracious me. And, you know, at that stage I was only 44 or something or other, and I'd been on the council for 2 or 3 years. But anyway, they'd picked me out and just become chairman of the finance committee, and so I said, I couldn't very well say no to those two fellas, and that's how I became chairman of the finance committee.
How did the university fit into the South Australian community at that stage? This is pre-Vietnam and all that.
I don't know that I can answer that in any intelligent way. It was it was, of course, at that stage, the only university Although it was in the shortly after I became a member of the council that the seeds of the Flinders University were sown, and so it was to become the University of Adelaide at Bedford Park, to be another campus, and Peter Carmel was appointed principal designate, and I was on the planning committee for the with Peter Carmel. I was one of the Adelaide representatives on the planning committee. That would have been in the first half of the 60s, but then when Dunstan first became Premier, he immediately set up the Flinders University as a separate entity. He didn't want it to be another campus of Adelaide. So
that was a state decision?
That was a state decision, yeah. It was a state decision to establish Flinders as a second university. But it was originally conceived as to be a second campus for Adelaide, and which caused quite a few problems, financial problems in particular, because among other things the University of Adelaide purchased additional land for the Flinders, although it had that big Bedford Park site, which I can remember walking all over with the architect planning where it was all to go and so on. But we also bought some land on the other side of South Road, which we called the Tobacco Land. It was in fact owned by Craven A, or it had to be Craven A, because we thought that the university might need some additional land in the future. So the University of Adelaide purchased the Tobacco Land, and then of course when Flinders was established, they had no money to buy it back from us. But eventually when Peter Carmel became chairman of the Universities Commission, he provided Flinders with sufficient money to repay Adelaide the money that we'd outlaid in purchasing property for Flinders.
Why was it seen as necessary to have a second campus initially?
Oh, I just think for in terms, you see, this, to forget, don't remember, this was before the pill, and I think the demographic predictions were that that we would need it. And Adelaide, after all, was the smallest campus of any of the Australian universities. It couldn't grow any larger, really, and all the demographic predictions at that stage were for population explosions, which would require a second university, or at least a second campus anyway. And also, of course, the southern suburbs were starting to expand and develop.
Yes. So it was that movement, and then I suppose the coming of the Dunstan government was a big change for South Australia, in effect. Well, the Walsh then Dunstan government.
Yeah.
After many years of Conservative government, there would have been a push down south.
Yes, it was. Playford was not personally very sympathetic, but that's why he planned to have a second campus for Adelaide University.
Was the state still supporting the university at that point?
Yes, it was. The funding was split between the Commonwealth and the states at that stage. I've forgotten what the ratio, I think it was 1.8 Commonwealth dollars to every one state dollar. It may have been the other way around. But I know that one thing Playford was insistent upon, that he would always give the university the maximum amount of its proportion, because so that he could get the maximum amount from the Commonwealth as well. It was certainly a jointly funded operation.
So from the years that you served on the Finance Committee, but particularly in the 60s at this point, Sam, well, was it financially workable, or was it always tight?
I have to say it was financially workable, but I also think I helped to make it financially workable. But when I became chairman, I was staggered to discover some of the financial structures. For instance, most of the university's so-called free money was invested in fixed interest government securities and debentures, with no capital growth at all. And low interest rates, electricity trust debentures and so on. I think the only sort of gilt-edged, other gilt-edged investment they had. I think they had some BHP shares. And I was instrumental in redeeming these fixed interest debentures and so on, and getting the money and establishing a proper equity portfolio, which of course turned out to be of a great advantage to the university in later years when the share market boomed and so on, and we made a lot of money. But it was very conservatively managed when I became chairman of the finance committee. There were other things that happened too. I mean, for instance, the Commonwealth money was always paid to the state treasury because they had no constitutional power to fund universities at that stage. So it was all done by way of grants in aid to the states under Section 96 of the Constitution.
Yes.
And they paid the money to the state. And they apparently paid it in two six-monthly tranches, I think they called it, or the word, something like that. Anyway, two. And the university simply used to call on the state treasury for money when it needed it. And I thought, well, this was sort of pretty funny. It was our money. Why didn't we have more control over it? So I went to see with the then new vice chancellor, which was Badger. I can tell you a bit about his appointment in a minute.
Mm.
We went to see Seaman, who was the state treasurer.
Yeah.
And he said, "I've been expecting you people for some years."
This is Gilbert Seaman.
Yeah, Gilbert Seaman. Because they had no right, they were using that money and investing it and so on the short-term money market. And so we got that money back into the under-university control and played the short-term money market ourselves with it. And so that helped to improve the finances as well. The government, the university management at that time was... Oh, Napier, of course, I think, was on the council. Napier and Wills and Lidgetwood, they would not, under any circumstances, rock the government boat. You know, they were very sort of content with a very conservative status quo.
Mm.
So we managed to release a bit of money for the university in that way, and so we managed all right. But then, of course, the whole scenario changed in 72 when Whitlam was elected, and it's a...
Now, Badger's appointment was prior to Whitlam, I would assume.
This was prior to Whitlam, yes.
Can you tell me about that, Sam?
About
Badger's appointment.
About Badger's appointment, yes. Ken Badger had been the professor of biochemistry or inorganic chemistry or something rather, but then he moved to what to him was a much more attractive position with CSIRO. And then Baston retired, and we had to get a new vice-chancellor. General discussion in the academic community said, "I wish we still had Badger." And I said, "Well, perhaps we can get him back." And they said, "Oh, I don't think you'll get him back because he left to improve his position and his opportunities for research and so on." I said, "Well, you never know till you try." And so I said, I remember saying to Ken Wills, "I wonder what we would have to do to lure Badger back." I said, "I wonder." At that stage, I understood that the basic vice chancellor salaries was professorial plus 50%. And I said, "I don't think that would get him back." And I said, "I'd like to find out what other vice chancellors are paid." And I said to Wills, who was then Chancellor, I think, I said, "I'm going to write to my counterparts in the other states, to the Chairman of the Finance Committee, and see if I can get some picture of Vice-Chancellor's remuneration throughout Australia." And Wills scoffed at me. He said, "You won't get an answer, you know." And I said, "Well, I'll be no worse off if I don't get an answer." In fact, I got six or seven answers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they all answered. And I can't remember the detail. But it was clear to me that most universities were giving some sort of financial entitlement or fringe benefits and so on to attract vice chancellors. So with that sort of information in front of me, we then approached Badger and worked out a deal to woo him back.
Mm.
And I've forgotten exactly what the deal was, but it was a bit better than an academic salary, a professorial salary plus 50%. I mean, we gave him a house and so on, things of this sort. And I think we also made some special arrangement for his superannuation at that stage as well. So we got him back, and he was, of course, a very good vice-chancellor for many years.
Yes, I recall people from all faculties saying that, say they were from arts or law, had been a bit concerned that he may not be what they'd hoped because he came from sciences.
Yeah.
But in fact,
he was very good.
He was very good.
Yes, he was very good. If he had one fault, it was he leant over backwards, to be fair. When sometimes he should have been a bit more decisive. There was the famous dispute between the botany people and what was his name? There's a gate up the Waite Institute named after one of them, and another one who was a bit of a. Anyway, there was a huge academic dispute, and Badger didn't handle that terribly well, and it led to a bit of litigation, which ultimately was solved, was settled. I can tell you their names, but one of the things, Robert, of old age is you forget names so easily.
I think you're doing a great job.
Andrew Author was one of them. Andrew Author,
yes.
And it began with an O. He had a very aggressive wife. They used to keep geese. Andrew Author was one. Andrew Author was the innocent victim of this feud. But Badger was very good, and Badger and I worked very closely together, and I became very fond of Badger. And he was a good vice chancellor.
Well, that was an era, though, for him of student unrest at university, wasn't
it? Yes,
it
was. It was a bit of student unrest over Vietnam in particular, in the late 1960s, and I think Bray had become Chancellor by this time.
Yes, that would be correct.
And I remember they came to the council room and burnt the flag in the council room or something like that. And Bray was a very peaceable man, and he was not strong. He couldn't really cope with this, but Badger was very good in talking to the militant students and trying to calm the waters a bit. He was very good at that.
Sam, I'll just set up a new recording session.